Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Jeff's rugby team will depart in 5 minutes from platform 15. Your ride comes with 6 toilets and a refreshments carriage that you'll empty within 5 minutes. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.
People always talk about, you know, following your passion or your dream. And I've never been into that advice because I often think your passion and your dream doesn't line up with what you're good at. Would I like to do something other than writing? Maybe. I can think of many things I'd like to do more than writing because it would be easier and they wouldn't, you know, AI would not be coming for my job.
Welcome to How Success Happens. I'm Dan Bova, writer and editor at entrepreneur.com. And I talk to a lot of people who build brands on this show, but today's guest builds universes. He is the best-selling author of the School for Good and Evil series, which has sold nearly 5 bajillion copies worldwide. I think that's the exact number. It was made into a Netflix flick, but all that's in the past, right? Because he has got an incredible new novel out. We're going to talk about that and talk about the cross-section of big picture creative thinking and putting your head down and grinding it out. Welcome, Soman Chinani.
Thanks so much for having me again. It's fun to get to kind of chart where things are 4 years later.
Yeah, well, the first time I talked to you, you were quite successful, but things are good in the Soman universe, I would say.
Well, you know, the funny thing is I felt like there was a peak to that version of my life, that chapter. You know, I'd written School for Good and Evil for 13 years. There were 6 books, 2 prequels, and then the movie came out. And the movie was kind of this, you know, high watermark. It's not that the movie sort of accurately captured the books in any shape, way, or form, but it brought a whole new readership to it. It just felt like it had created this self-sustaining franchise that would live on now and was bigger than the author. And it just felt like it was time to move on to something else. And that's exactly when I met, you know, my partner. And so the combo of those things, moving to a new place, being with a new person, kind of blowing up my life and realizing I needed a change, I was being offered so much money to write more fairy tales. You know, I just could have been the good Indian boy salesman that my dad wanted me to be and just kept banking money on fairy tales, you know? And I tried. I was going to write a series about Neverland. And that's what I had told everybody. We were already trying to pitch the film before I'd even written a word of it. And I made it 2 chapters in and then never opened the document again.
Wow. So I did want to talk to you about that. And of course, what we're talking about today is Soman's incredible new book that we'll get all into. But I'm so interested in that because, you know, whether it's a book or a TV show or a business, we all have so many ideas that hit us, you know, day in, day out. And I'm always so curious about how someone like you decides this is the one that I'm going to go all in on. And then what was that decision like? What drove that decision to say, I put in all this work, but this just isn't going the way I wanted it?
I think I'm lucky in that I remember hearing Madonna in an interview when I was younger. I was a big Madonna fan. And she said something that stayed with me forever, which is that when you are an artist, you are not the artist. You are the manager. The artist is, you never meet the artist. The artists are the elves inside you that are doing the work. You know, you are unconscious to the elves. You are just the manager. And so I always kind of never took responsibility for my own art. I felt like I was just the guy who showed up and wrote it all down, you know? And so when I went to work on Neverland, I was writing these 2 chapters, but I could feel resistance, this feeling of like, there's no energy here. This is very competent and this will sell a lot, but it's missing it, like whatever the fizzy thing is. And so I just never went back to it because to me, like, what's the point? I'd rather be a plumber or something. And I think I started to tune in. I had spent 13 years in a fantasy world, escaping the world. And I started to tune into what was happening in the world. And what I noticed is I had been on tour in, you know, hundreds of schools over the years, and kids were changing. I was noticing how stressed they were, how anxious they were, you know, how they were reading less, the phones, all that stuff. And I started to have visions of this neon nuclear orange. And I was like, I don't know if this is a fairy tale. I don't know where I'm going with this. And little by little, I started to realize it was the color of a political party, that you had red for Republicans, blue for Democrats, and you had this new nuclear neon orange. And I started to realize this is a third political party, and it's going to be the party of revolting youth. And that's where the idea for this new book, Young World, came 3.5 years ago.
Is that a first for you, being inspired by a color, or do things like that inspire you all the time?
It was the first, I think, in terms of something so strong, because I think what I was just only thinking in the fairy tale realm, because I thought that's what I was limited to. Yeah. And I think my brain was like, okay, how do we get them off fairy tales? What if we give them a color that could never exist in the fairy tale world, which was, you know, I don't know if you can see it. It's so funny because the final book is this Dayglow nuclear orange that I'm holding.
Yeah.
And Dayglow does not show up digitally. So no matter how many times I take pictures of it, how many times I show people to it, you do not understand the color of this book until you see it in person. And when you see it at a bookstore, you know, anybody listening, you'll be like, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
But there's just no way to capture. I'm staring at it right now and I'm like, that looks nothing like what it did on screen.
I can attest to that, because when I opened the package, when it came in, I was like, this is going to be something different. And, and it is. I mean, the writing is amazing. It's funny. It is diabolical. There's betrayal. There's all kinds of crazy stuff that goes on. Mm. And there's also what I love, and I'll see if I can open randomly to a page. So what's happening inside the book is there's all kinds of images. There's posters, there's graphs, there's you know, social media clips and stuff like that. And I was curious, was that a part of your original vision of this book, or did that evolve as you were writing it?
I turned in the first 50 pages of the book to my agent in, I think, January 2023. And I hadn't told him what I was working on. I think he was expecting Neverland. So I sent this in and was like, here. And I was expecting a phone call being like, dude, you got to go back to what you're good at. Like, just get out. Like, I was expecting the yelling phone call. And he called and he goes, this idea is amazing, but what you've turned into me is very bad. And I was like, okay, I can work with that. Why is it bad? And he goes, it's bad because you're writing it like School for Good and Evil. You're doing it in third person. It's very lush and sophisticated and has like a Jane Austen undertone to it. It's very romantic. Like, he's like, you're telling the story of a teenage boy who just leads a revolution against the government and then which leads to a global revolution. Like, it needs a new tone. This is not, you're a professional athlete who is leaving your sport to do a completely different sport. It's got to look different. And that's when I took a few weeks and just kind of tried to clear my head and said, okay, if we're going to do this, we're going to do this. What would a teenage boy's diary look like? And I changed it to first person. It became the diary of a 17-year-old teenager who, through a series of dominoes, ends up in the White House because of a global coup. And I realized that it would just be a no-holds-barred diary with everything shoved in, all the stuff he's seeing, like sort of crinkled in and doodles and stuff. I thought if it was a teenage girl who was president, it would be all prose, and it would be like exactly what you would imagine a diary to be. A teenage boy's diary would be highly undisciplined. And so telling myself the diary was going to be undisciplined was the key to the book.
That's amazing. And working with, I mean, you've collaborated with people, obviously, or your books got made into movies and all this kind of stuff. But what's that process like from the day one of these are the visuals that are going to be in the book? How do you get that, your vision, across to them? How do you receive ideas that weren't exactly what you were thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was coming off the School for Good and Evil movie, and I went to film school. That's my training before I was a novelist. And so to me, I said, okay, if we're going to do this book properly, it's got to feel like you're reading a movie. Like, that's really what it has to feel like. because a teenage boy thinks visually. So there's going to be a full 120,000 word novel in there, but there's also going to be a novel happening in separate visuals. And so I told the publisher, I said, I'm paying for all the art. Like, it's, you know, I basically spent all my advance on artists. I hired three different artists because I wanted to control it. I wanted it to be like, okay, this is my film. I want to work directly with the artists and not have any interference. So I hired three friends, one who's just a great design mind, very classical, almost cerebral in the way he thinks. One who's a fantasy illustrator, who had worked with me on a lot of School for Good and Evil stuff. And one who was just like a Gen Z madman. He's almost like Animal in the Muppets. Like, I don't know what he's good at, but he can kind of do everything. So anything we didn't know what to do with, like we just were lost with, we gave to him.
That's great.
So, you know, we had kind of high art, we had high design, and then we had insanity. And so the mix of those three, I think, gave a kind of really cool vibe to the book because every visual is sort of different and you have the inconsistency of design in modern life.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And it comes together so beautifully in the book. It's amazing. So tell me a little bit about the day-to-day of it. Like, what's a day in a life of you when you're working on something like?
You know, it's interesting because it depends on where you are in the process, right? So when you're writing a book, so for the 2.5 years of just pure writing, I get up in the morning, I go play tennis with one of the kids from the local college teams. So WashU, SLU, Maryville, like these kids come play with me in the mornings because I have a style. Obviously, I pay them to show up at 6 a.m., but I also have a style that makes them crazy because they haven't seen it. And so Gen Z kids are like totally mystified by 90s tennis. And they tend to send their friends to me because they're like, it's like being hustled. You know, they just don't know what to do. So I do that every morning. And then I come home and play for, and then write for, 4 or 5 hours. And then again, I go for a second box of exercise working with a trainer. And then I write again. And then usually I hang with my partner, go out at night. That's a typical day that I try to repeat over and over and over again, almost for years until the book is done. But I would say the last 4 months, because this is, you have to remember, 13 years I was writing the same series. So it was like clockwork, was a machine. This, I have to reintroduce myself. So this was starting over. I have to be everywhere. So I had to go back into salesman mode starting in mid-February. And it's just a different job. You know, you're on the road a lot. You're talking about the book. You're learning how to talk about the book and you're not getting as much time to write. So that's what now it's like every day is a wild card day. I feel like more a CEO than I do a writer,
because
it's like managing an operation of trying to put this book out. And so it's a completely different skill set.
And during that time that you are writing, would you describe it? Are you getting into like a flow state with it? Are you starting and stopping? Like, what's it like when you're in it?
Oh, every day is different. Some, you know, you're just kind of slogging along, trying to get to something interesting, you know, and sometimes you're just possessed. The later you get in a book, the more you're possessed by momentum. Mm. But I think in the early days, I don't work off an outline because I just feel like outlines end up leading to like a flat book because I know what's going to happen. I like to be surprised as I go. Mm. And so I just feel like I'm just kind of sculpting it. You know, you just have this big block of ice and you're chipping away at it and sort of finding things as you go. So it's very intuitive. It can be very frustrating. But you're just trying to get to it, a draft that works.
So let's talk about frustration a little bit. For anyone who's feeling stuck with whatever thing that they're working on, what seems to work for you? It sounds like physical exercise is a huge part of your life. Is that part of breaking yourself out of a stuck spot?
100%. I think you need to get to a place where your whole body has blood flowing, you know, because we too often think the answer's in our head. It's not in our head. It's sort of in there. It's in the flow, and the flow is in your body. So I often feel like when you have the answer, it's inevitable. It's like it's going to come out no matter what. You're usually just clogging it or restricting it somehow. So I think modern life, especially if, you know, you live alone or you're alone a lot, it's so easy to fill the silence, you know, with podcasts or with audiobooks or something. And you just don't have the space for your brain to actually give you the ideas. So my partner's farm is about an hour away. Sometimes I just try not to listen to anything for that hour and find myself kind of drifting into getting the answers I need, or, you know, in the shower, just on a walk, like leaving myself space to actually get ideas. And I think that's something that modern life has restricted, and you don't realize it. So yeah. I think, you know, people always talk about getting up at 3 a.m. and it's a stress condition. And I always think of it as your brain is just backed up with processing and you haven't given it enough room.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. So in keeping with there's so much content and voices coming at us all the time, when it comes to writing or kind of any creative endeavor, there's a lot of advice out there. And I wonder, you brought up one thing, but is there any advice that you've heard that you think bears repeating, and also anything you wish people would ignore?
I think it's important that people always talk about, you know, following your passion or your dream. And I've never been into that advice, because I often think your passion and your dream doesn't line up with what you're good at. I think the thing you should be pursuing is the intersection of something that you're good at and something that makes time go by very quickly. So, you know, writing is a pain in the ass. Like, would I like to do something other than writing? Maybe. I can think of many things I'd like to do more than writing, because it would be easier and they wouldn't, you know, AI would not be coming for my job. But writing I'm good at, and it makes time go by quickly, so quickly that I'm always fighting the clock. And I feel like that's, and I feel fulfilled at the end of the day. I feel like something has happened, like there's been some transmutation that I need. So I always think to find that combination of what are you good at, what makes time go by quickly, that's where you should be headed in order to find your spot.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So you just mentioned two letters, AI, big issue in the publishing world. Have you, what are your thoughts? I gather you're not a fan.
No. I mean, look, it was going to happen regardless. There was going to be this time where we tried to automate it, you know, automate human intelligence. And I was just talking to a group of 300 high schoolers this morning about the new book. And I was like, how many of you use AI? And they all raised their hand. And I raised my hand too, because we all use it at some point during the day. And I said, here's the problem. At your age, you're learning how to think, right? And so AI is meant to replace that thinking power, which is why they want you to use it as much as possible, to train your brain to immediately go to it as sort of a substitute thinker, in the way that we use calculators instead of actually doing everything by hand. The issue is, at your age, some of you are going to have an above average moment in your life. Hopefully all of you, right? But AI is the average. And if you learn to use AI for everything, then you are sort of putting yourself at the average line of humanity, right? And if you are going to be below average for the rest of your life in everything, in every way you think for the rest of your life, please use AI. It's only going to make humanity better, because you're going to be raising your level to at least some base standard. But if some of you plan on having above average moments and maybe having feats of ingenuity or inventing new things, or, you know, finding the full realization of yourself, then you can't use it now, because it's flattening out what you're going to become. And we talked a lot about the college essay and how, you know, the college essay, when you apply to college, everyone's using AI now. So they all sound great, but they're all very flat. And so ultimately, you know, if you're looking at natural evolution and selection, what are college counselors going to be looking for? Two things. One, a distinctive voice, even if it sounds much worse than AI, even if it's something authentic is going to cut through. And two, they're going to look for something that feels specific and that has a strong kind of like desire to it, because AI loves to flatten desire. It loves to somehow take it, it's averaging to the mean, right? So it doesn't like hot spikes of passion. It doesn't like intensity, right? So, you know, trying to go into these schools, and this is what I would do. This is what I'll be doing with Young World when I'm on tour, but I would love to do it more, is just go into schools and talk to kids about how, if you can get your college essay right so that it reflects you and what you are as a person, I feel like you're going to get so intoxicated by that feeling, then you're going to want to write yourself.
Such a great way to frame it. I love that. Really, that's I haven't heard anyone put it like that, but it's so true. And as a recipient of something that is AI written, I don't know why, but we can all recognize it in a second. So you're not fooling anybody. So
on fiction side, I'm not so sure about the nonfiction side. I think there's so many articles being written with it now that I almost feel like we've gotten used to that sort of dead kind of prose, the dead flat prose.
Yeah.
But which makes me wonder whether the future of sort of nonfiction writing in a way is perspectives, almost having this like first person, you know, view of a story in order to counteract that feeling. You know, for Young World, I had lots of offers of doing op-eds and things because I'm really pushing getting rid of the age gate around the presidency to allow young people to run. And I felt like it's just going to sound like it's going to sound like a normal op-ed. It's going to be very hard to make it distinctive, you know?
Right.
And so I was like, I'd like to find a place where I could do it in first person and make it more personal so that it doesn't feel like AI. And I think this push towards the personal, the authentic is going to be super important, which is why I think reading fiction is important, because that's how you start to get deeper into character that you can then bring to your own nonfiction business job.
Yeah, absolutely. And we talk about it all the time. Some of the most successful people who've been on the show talk about that. Your audience, your customers, they want an authentic person. They want an authentic brand that authentically speaks to what they believe in. And you're not going to get that, as you said, just equaling out every opinion on earth.
That's what it is. It's every opinion on earth.
The book is out in May. What's the exact date?
May 5th.
So that should be right as this episode is coming out. I heartily recommend people picking it up because we live in a crazy world, but someone has created an even crazier one. So it's.
I know it's crazy, but I think it's a solution to everything. I firmly believe this is actually not a speculative fiction book. I kind of want it to come true.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get into a couple of speed round questions if you're ready. Okay. So what is a book you always recommend, fiction and nonfiction?
Oh, good. The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield for nonfiction. Super short, and it just teaches you how to get over resistance to your work. And then fiction, I love A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara because it's just so immersive. And there's something about that book that is like a fever dream. It just kidnaps you, and then you're gone.
What is a classic that you think should have its must-read rating revoked?
Oh, that's interesting. I was just rereading... I have lots of them, but Scarlet Letter, because I hate the Scarlet Letter. I don't know why they make kids read it. It's so boring. And then one that I think everyone should read, especially now that the movie came out, is Wuthering Heights, because Wuthering Heights, the novel, looks nothing like that movie that just came out. It's crazy, that book. And there's something about, I feel like if you make people read it, they'll think classics are fun because it's unhinged. That book is more unhinged than anything written these days. Like I remember when 50 Shades of Grey came out and everyone was going crazy about how taboo it was and everything. I'm like, has anyone read Wuthering Heights? It's so much worse.
Wow. All right. Well, that you just put it on my next list. That sounds pretty good. Do audiobooks count as reading?
100%, but especially with nonfiction, because you get the, I'm listening to Lena Dunham's memoir now, and there's something about, you know, nonfiction read by the writer that is just, you feel it, you know. Fiction is trickier because you can get a pretty shitty narrator. But I think fiction, it's better to have your imagination do it, I think. But anything to get people, you know, reading books.
I got to say, I listen to a lot of audiobooks when I'm walking, and I've been listening to like some like classic noir stuff, and hearing a guy like start to try to give the voice of the breathy woman who just came into the office is one of the funny
Oh man, that's where it breaks down. I, you know, for the School for Native audiobook, they gave me all these options and I said, we can't use any of these. We have to use my friend. They're like, has she ever done an audiobook? I said, no, but she can do every voice on the planet. And she ended up doing 8 books.
Wow.
That's she did awesome. 170 characters. I mean, so you just need someone who can do them.
That's excellent. And then finally, what's better, the book or the movie?
Oh, I've never seen, let me see if I can actually say that. Have I ever seen a movie better than the book? Yes, The Bridges of Madison County with Clint Eastwood and Meryl Streep is one of the best movies I have ever seen. And that book is useless. So I think that movie was pretty special.
That's fantastic. Well, you know, you're so reserved with your opinions, but I'm glad we...
I wish I was, but then I'd be like AI, right? I have to say.
Yeah. Amen. That's great. Awesome. Well, so great talking to you again. Young World is out May 5th, and I heartily recommend it. And you will not have any problem spotting it in the bookstore. That's for sure.
Definitely not.